afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. You can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com, where you can subscribe to our newsletter to find out about upcoming guests, features, events, and other shows on our network. If you have any questions or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please visit us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email to questions@theorganicview.com. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking to Patricia Foreman, who is an amazing, amazing person, and she has authored several books, one of which we're going to be talking about today, which is called City Chicks. For those of you that have thought about raising chickens, it's something that is actually not that hard to do, but you really need to know what you're doing. And also you have to be considerate of the fact that in the area that you may live, it may not be prohibited. More and more people are actually raising chickens due to the inhumane practice of factory farms and also the use of antibiotics for folks that wish to grow food organically, locally, and sustainably. Raising chickens has been the most popular method to do the right things for the environment as well as for yourself. Now, across America, municipalities are allowing and even encouraging residents to keep laying hens within city limits. And in the book, City Chicks, Patricia Foreman gets into everything that you need to know as far as raising chickens, how to keep them safe, and also how to just really develop a relationship. And some people are discovering what's called a chicken whisperer, which Pat will get into a little bit later. I had the pleasure of meeting her at the Mother Earth News Festival, and she had the star of City Chicks, Ms. Oprah Henfrey. And let me tell you, what a beautiful, beautiful bird. So I would like to welcome to the show Pat Foreman. Good afternoon, Pat.
Yeah, hi, June. It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you so much for having me as a guest.
Thank you, Pat. How many books do you have out at this point?
Well, depends how you count them, June. I get, I would say five. We'll go with five.
Wow. And, you know, just watching you with Oprah Henfrey was, you could tell how much love you have for your chickens. It's not just some type of kooky hobby. It's something that you're very passionate about. And you could tell by the relationship between you and Oprah Henfrey, should I say, that, you know, you definitely have that special bond with her. And I think that's very important. And it's interesting. People don't respect chickens. They don't understand how smart they are and how caring they are. I mean, it's interesting. When I grew up on my parents' farm, we would see mother hens just care for other babies.
Mm-hmm.
And human beings won't even do that. It's amazing. Human beings, they won't take in another person's child, but yet with chickens, especially hens, they will care for another being's offspring and treat them and raise them as their own.
Well, they can. Sometimes they will just take a little baby chick under wing, so to speak. But there's also times when they'll reject them and be pretty mean to them. So they do have their peculiarities, just like people in so many ways. Yeah, June, you were talking about Oprah Henfrey and how she really was the star. I must admit, I was just her sidekick in so many ways because she's there. You know, so many people have never seen a live chicken before. It's been amazing to me at just about every place I go, much less been able to touch one and pet them, and to see that you don't have to, you know, they're not these brainless, squawking, flighty, you know, dirty beings that it's just kind of the archetype that comes to people's minds. So she's really a poultry ambassador out there changing the archetype and the way people look and view chickens. So,
you know, it's interesting. I think part of that reason is because we are so completely disconnected with agriculture. I recently had Joel Saladin on the show, and he was talking about just not only the books that he's written, but just some of his own personal experiences and observations. And people are completely disconnected with agriculture. I mean, it's interesting when you talk to kids about chickens. Most of them have no idea that they have feathers. They have no idea what they sound like. They think that chicken is basically something that comes in the shape of a dinosaur, not even a real shape of a dinosaur, and breaded and ready to heat and serve.
They do. Chickens have descended from dinosaurs. In fact, there is a little bit of Tyrannosaurus Rex in your little feathery backyard friend. they're amazing creatures. They truly are.
Yeah, and it's a shame because they're really wonderful. I mean, they can be alarm clocks. They can be very affectionate. They're just great when it comes to helping you keep some of the little pests away from your tomatoes. Hopefully they won't nibble too much on your lettuce. They're just great to have in every yard. And personally, I think chicken manure is probably the best as far as fertilizer.
Well, it is. In fact, it's interesting that the chicken manure has an NPK, you know, nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus levels that rival commercial agriculture. And, of course, when it's in the right place and in the right amounts, it becomes such a valuable asset or organic asset to backyard agriculture. And that's one of the places where chickens shine. One of their skill sets is providing organic, non-toxic local agriculture. As well as you'd mentioned, being pesticiders. I mean, chickens are voracious carnivores. And they'll go around and literally glean ticks and fleas off your yard, as well as grasshoppers and moths and even slugs. So they can substitute us for some of the pesticides that we've got. And there's quite a bit to learn about that. I mean, in some ways, we're still exploring how to employ chickens in local agricultural systems. But they're pretty handy.
Yes, exactly. And what I think is also nice is that, you're dealing with another being that is basically a natural fit for the environment, whereas all of these chemicals that we constantly keep dumping, it winds up back into our bodies. And people just don't get that. But it's interesting that so many people are taking classes, buying books, just asking for information about how they can raise chickens in their own backyards. And you know something, you don't need to have a big farm in order to do that. What are some of the trends that you've seen, Pat, as far as in the urban areas?
Well, June, what's wonderful is in the past 5 years alone, over 500 towns and cities have changed their laws to allow residents to keep chickens. I mean, the trend has not even started to crest yet. I know across North America, not just only the U.S., but also Canada. And what's also interesting is in England, they're wondering, what's the big deal in America about chickens? They don't quite get why we don't all just have chickens in our backyards, those who want them. And the response to that is, well after World War II, June, Europe knew what it was to be pummeled and to have food shortages. So in truth, in most of the European countries, the chickens never left the backyards because they were so much of the local food supply during those war years, and it was so valuable. So in many ways, we're coming back round to a back-to-the-land movement that I think is even more significant than it was in the 60s, you know, with Helen and Scott Nearing. But this time, the back-to-the-land movement is to people's backyards. And that's what's so exciting, because we're discovering that it really can grow a lot, I mean a lot, of produce and food on small plots of land between the development. So it's an interesting time we're in.
Mm-hmm. Especially with, I just had Sylvia Bernstein on talking about aquaponics. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's so many things that we can do, and the education is getting out there. And the bottom line, when you have these agrochemical companies saying that, oh, there's going to be a shortage of food and we need to push forward with GMOs in order to be able to accommodate that population, it is such a marketing scheme. It's propaganda that they're pushing in order to sell GMOs. And the bottom line is that people have food around them. We have so much food. It's just we don't recognize what is food. And unfortunately, because of the fact that we did change after World War II, I mean, we went through this phase where we stopped using the lawn for, or land rather, for mm-hmm. agricultural means, and we started getting more into ornamental land, if you will, where the front lawn was something that was not used for agriculture. It was basically a piece of land that was kept just for ornamental reasons and nothing more. And now there's a resurgence. I'm starting to see more and more people that are using their front property, planting different types of gardens, whether it's an herb garden, rock garden, you know, all sorts of different things. They're trying to really change the landscape and make it more friendlier for pollinators, but also more productive as far as for culinary purposes, so on and so forth. So that's a very nice change to see. And I think a lot of that does have to do, as you pointed out, with the economy, because more and more people are being forced, because they don't have the money to go out, they're planting containers, they're planting in their own gardens at home, they're making gardens, they're participating in community gardens in some of the city areas so that they can not only participate and get back some of the vegetables, but, you know, contribute, and it does help communications within the community. So it's a really big plus side to this economy tanking for the last couple of years. So it's, you know, it's interesting how things happen. And I think the fact that all these things have come about at the perfect time, as you pointed out, isn't there a movement that's going on with backyard chickens, Pat?
Oh, absolutely. There's an incredibly strong movement going on with backyard chickens. And, you know, what you were saying, June, how people are converting so much of their lawns to food production or to edible landscape. One of the interesting statistics that I really find fascinating is you probably know the answer to this, but what's the most irrigated, fertilized crop in America? The most irrigated and fertilized crop in America. And a lot of people will say corn or soybeans or cotton, and no, it's not marijuana either. but what it is we've got over about 30 to 40 million acres of lawn, fescue, grass. So and that doesn't include horse farms, but it does include parks and, of course, in people's yards and backyards, front yards, green space. So Robert Rodel, just before he died, said that he felt, you know, Robert Rodel of Prevention Magazine and Organic Gardening, he felt that the farm of the future would be these hyperproductive chinks. You know, chinks is a little, that little thing, mortar between the brick, these hyperproductive chinks of land between the subdivisions, between the development. And I think he's absolutely right. And that's why this Back to the Land movement is so strong. It's because we've got land that's already irrigated and fertilized or has access to that, and we can turn it into hyperproductive chinks of land to grow a lot of our food. And of course, the common statistic that goes around with the victory gardens of Eleanor Roosevelt in World War II is they produced 40% of all the produce that was consumed in America during those war years. And, of course, that was before the artificial and plant enhancement products really came into being. They generally came in right after World War II, after 1945. So there is a tremendous potential and possibility for food production locally, but we need a paradigm shift. We need a different view of how we produce our food and what really local food does mean, that does mean to local economies.
You know, enter Occupy Backyard.
That's right, Occupy Backyard. Can I tell the story about Oprah Winfrey?
Please.
Yeah, I was doing a book tour in California. It was a 6-week book tour, and on the second day of the tour, I was in Santa Barbara and giving a presentation, an evening presentation at the Santa Barbara Public Library, beautiful building, really upscale. And I had Oprah Winfrey, Buff Orpington Hen, was on my arm, just sitting there, you know, as I was fiddling with the microphone, and I was up by the podium, and she decided to hop up on the podium. And, of course, there's about 150 people or so in the audience going, oh, my God, you know, the who's chicken, what are you going to do? And I knew she wouldn't go anywhere, so I finally got my microphone figured out. And she had then proceeded to the top of the podium, you know, and then she started going, brah, 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 brah. So I just put the microphone up there. She came over the loudspeakers talking. We finally figured out she was trying to speak to represent the 99% of all the chickens in the world who don't have a voice, and calling forth to occupy backyards where chickens can enable local agriculture. So that's the Occupy Backyards movement that's going on with chickens.
I've actually been honored by Tom Theobald, who has named one of his chicks, last year, who's really quite a pretty bird. She's got blondish feathers, and he calls her his June chicken. So now I officially, I must be doing something right. I have a chicken that's named after me.
There you go. That's right. That's great.
And,
well, I can name a chicken after you. I'll name one of you.
I just think it's great. Now, Pat, what is the first thing that people need to know about before they go out and start buying all this stuff? How do you know that raising hens is for you?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's something people actually torment themselves over. And I think what they need to know is just don't be afraid of them. The chickens are easier to keep than dogs, and they're just such easy beings. They're such easy keepers, and they can be kept in such a relatively small space. And they'll literally work for chicken feed, which is not that much. There's a saying, June, that goes, first people get chickens, then they fall in love. And I've heard that from people over and over and over again, saying, oh, I wish I had done this decades ago. Why did I wait so long? You know, my husband drug his feet and finally convinced him, and now he can't stop watching and being with the chickens. So I would say just do it. And it doesn't take that much. They're very simple to keep. The equipment's not expensive. Coops are easy to build, and you can build very elegant ones and whimsical ones, but they don't have to cost, you know, $300-$400 necessarily. So, on the other hand, I know people that have chicken coops that are designer built and designed by architects, and they're thousands of dollars. So,
people tend to go a little overboard. It's like composting. I mean, I've seen so many people that have said to me, you know, I just spent X amount of dollars on this really cool composter, and I look at them like, why? Why spend money on something that you could build yourself? I'm not a carpenter. I am not really handy when it comes to tools and stuff. That's why I usually call my brothers. When it comes to composting, I mean, it's not that complicated. It just requires a little bit of effort, like with anything else. And the same thing with chickens. I think the primary thing that people need to remember is you can't just get hens and then say, oh, you know, it's going to be like any other pet that you've adopted and just basically, you know, you give it minimal attention. It doesn't work that way. It's a big commitment. And the thing is that you also have to think about how they are protected, especially at night when they're the most vulnerable, especially from predators.
Right, right. Yeah, it is a commitment. There's no question about that. And they do. The interesting thing, June, is we're about 3 to 4 generations away from any animal husbandry skills. Again, right after World War II, that was such a tipping point. Just about all the livestock disappeared from the urban areas where they were before. And so one of the things we're finding, and I think that's a lot of the resistance against chickens, is they just don't know what's involved and how to handle them and what, you know, what care they need. So there's a lot of fear there. But that's one of the reasons. I mean, after you take one or two, either read a few books on keeping and raising chickens, and there are plenty of them out there. But it's just not that hard. And what you say about protection, especially from predators, is really true, including human predators, we're finding out, can sometimes be a problem.
Well, it could be dogs. It could be cats. It doesn't matter what the location is. It could be raccoons. You have all sorts of predators that are lurking out there. And the bottom line is that do you have a setup that will protect these beings at night. I mean, whether you're an animal person or not, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is that it still is an expense to be considered. And if you don't have the right setup, and I'm not talking about just putting them in some little hole in the wall at night, you have to have some humane place where they can be comfortable, where they will be dry, and they'll be protected.
Right, and they like to be up off the ground. They like to roost on a perch up. One of the things that makes chickens so vulnerable, June, is they're night blind. They are totally night blind, so they cannot see anything after dark. And of course, the night predators, they're all out there stalking. So one of the best ways to keep your chickens safe from nighttime predators is just make sure that lock can't be fiddled with and opened by a raccoon, or they can't get in through a hole or dig underneath to get into the roost. So that's probably the primary, I think, consideration about keeping chickens is the nighttime predators. During the day, it tends to be dogs, or foxes or coyotes. So So in that sense, then my chickens, I've got two poultry protecting canines. I mean, they're out there kind of watching, and they've done a wonderful job protecting my flock. But sometimes you'll also need to have a perimeter fence, or need to keep them contained, where it's not so much to keep the chickens in as to keep the predators out in many situations.
Now, Pat, where do you begin? I mean, do you get roosters? Do you need roosters? Or when it comes to purchasing the hens, how many do you need if you just want to start small?
Okay, well, to start with the rooster question, you do not need a rooster to get eggs from a hen. Many places, in fact, disallow roosters because of their crowing. Their crowing is about the same decibel level as a barking dog, but it's shrill, and it can go through the night, especially on full moons. So many places view roosters as causing noise pollution and have them banned, or only with special permits. If you do have a rooster, the general rule of thumb is maybe anywhere from one rooster to about every 8 to 10 hens. It can be a range from 8 to 13. I do know of small flocks, micro flocks, that might have three or four hens, and one rooster gets by and does quite nicely. The nice thing about roosters is they do have a job, and they do serve a function, and that is they're predator alerts, and they will even be very gallant and sacrifice themselves before they'll let a fox or a coyote or just about anything get to their hens. So that's they protect the hens. They'll show them where food is. I mean, they'll sort of make sure they all get in at night. They do really serve a role.
I've been pecked by many roosters. I remember the first time that I encountered a leghorn. This thing was just, it seems like it was enormous, but I was a kid at the time, and it got me right in the forehead. Got my brother,
ooh,
too. And
pecking?
Yeah. Oh. Jumped up and pecked us. And,
oh, wow. Jumped up, yeah.
Petrified us.
Well,
but,
with good reason.
They are quite protective, and, you know, they're beautiful birds.
Well, they're beautiful, and they can be incredibly personable. Not all of them are aggressive, and it's kind of a fine line because, you know, they're part of their job is to protect the flock, and you want them to do that, and yet you don't want them to come after you or little kids or the family dog. So any rooster that tends to be aggressive towards me or my dogs or other people, I usually send them to freezer camp. I just don't want to I don't want to breed that much of aggressiveness in through the next lines. But then too, they can really hurt you. I mean, there's spurs, these little that can be dagger like that can pretty well slash. So I don't keep dangerous roosters around.
They do happen. I mean, they do occur, should I say, or can be found. I'm trying to find the right words.
Roosters happen.
Yeah.
They just
happen. About the memories. Yeah, it's, you know, they're beautiful and they do serve a purpose, as you said, but depends. It depends upon what you're looking to do. Some people could care less if they're woken up by a rooster. Personally, I think geese are more... more disturbing, but, you know, once again, geese are perfect alarm clocks. and the perfect watchdog, so to speak. But, you know, roosters are, once again, not something that you necessarily need. I think I personally think that if people are going to start out, especially if they don't know what they're doing, they should, as you described, start off with the microflocks, because I think that that's a smarter approach, because then you can see what exactly is involved before you get too crazy. I mean, people tend to go nuts, and if you've got 100 baby chicks and you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, that can be quite intimidating. You're right.
Well, yeah, and plus the baby chicks will die, the majority of them, especially if you don't know how to care for them properly. And, you know, once again, if you're going to do something that you've never done before, doesn't matter how many books you've read, do it slowly.
Yeah. Start small and do it slowly. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think people ask me all the time, how many should I get? What's the ideal number of chicks? And I think I'm going to give a range, June, but I think the minimum number of hens or chickens should be about 3. Because they're very social, they need company, and then that allows for attrition. If one of them gets picked off or you know, there's always something that will love your chickens more than you, kind of thing, with the predators. But then also, I think city codes, we're encouraging them to consider 6 to 12 chickens to be allowed within the cities, because then it allows for attrition to have replacement chicks as they come along, or replacement hens. And then also, if we're looking forward towards food self-sufficiency, if you've got at least, say, 2 hens for every person in the household, you'll have enough eggs, because by allowing for 2 in the household, you can, the older ones will lay a little fewer eggs as they get older, and then the younger ones maybe haven't started laying eggs, because they don't begin laying until about 5 to 6 months old. So that's my recommended number, is anywhere from 6 to 12 for within city limits, and that's enough then also to possibly give to your neighbors or have some extra. So keep the flock small. I think Tractor Supply has a sales policy of only you have to buy at least 6 chicks, and I think that's a good thing.
What I think some people are also doing, especially if they are doing the microflock style or method, whatever you want to call it, size, I guess, they are going in with other people, and people that they find in, whether it's an online community or even a local club, where they are, you know, talking to other people that are looking to do this and looking to learn at the same time. And it's a great way to also cut your expenses in half, especially if there are minimum requirements. And I know with beekeeping, a lot of the beekeeping clubs, they do that because you get a break on the shipping, or you might even get free shipping. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just something that kind of makes sense. Plus, it's always nice to have a buddy where you can call somebody and say, hey, you know, I don't know what I should do, this is what happened, so on and so forth. Or if you need a hand with something, or if you happen to be traveling and have to be out of town for a couple of days, you need somebody who knows what they're doing and can make sure everything is okay while you're away.
Yeah, right, absolutely. There's a comment in the chat room here, June. It's from Walter. He says he has some very tame roos. And that's a really good point. Not all roosters turn aggressive, mm-hmm. and I've got one that I can just go up and pick up any time, and he'll pop his head on my shoulder, you know, he'll sit on my arm, but he's so heavy, he weighs about 10 pounds, so it's a little hard to kind of manage him the way I can hens. But
we had many roosters that were great. It's just the first introduction to roosters up on my parents' farm, that's basically what happened. And I always think back about that time, because we had 2 roosters that were white, and one was mean and the other one was really just gentle. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't tell the difference between the two of them, other than the fact that one wasn't really nice and the other one was. Yeah, I wasn't trying to say that all roosters are mean. They're not.
No, no, no. And the other thing that you pointed out earlier, too, June, is that roosters do happen. Even if you order from the hatcheries and you say you get what's all females, the chances are that the sexing isn't 100%, and eventually you'll get a rooster. And of course, that's then what do you do? I mean, that's something that always comes up. in the discussions. And there are several things that several ways to manage roosters if they're illegal in the city. One of the things is that something we should talk about here?
Yeah, please.
That's
a good point.
Roosters, again, it's the noise throughout the night. But one of the things you can do is, of course, always find a home for them. There usually will be someone outside the city that will take a rooster for you. We have the Natural Bridge Zoo here in Rockbridge County, and they'll take any unwanted chicken, and they use it for big cat food for the lions and the tigers and that sort of thing. They put them down very humanely. So that's one, you know, passing along the life to go. Our Poultry and Garden Club, as we have several members, myself included, that any bird, anywhere, anytime, will come rescue or take care of if it's not wanted or find a home for it. And, of course, there's always the tailgate kind of solutions where you can go to one of these livestock solutions and see if someone will buy your rooster for you. And then finally, I know of about 5 homesteaders that would love to have any extra roosters. And yes, they'll process them, but, you know, the rooster's life hasn't gone in vain, I guess you'd say. So those are some of the options. If you have roosters and darn can't keep them, there almost always is someone that will help you out and find a home for it one way or another.
I personally would prefer that, you know, you try to find a home where it's not going to wind up at somebody's dinner or otherwise, but...
eventually that seems to be a rooster's fate, whether it's a predator, a human, or a bacteria and fungus. You know, we all end up being dinner for someone, something, some being somewhere, somehow. So that's just the cycle of life.
Now, with roosters and hens, what actually is the lifespan of a hen and of a rooster? If you had one of each and you fed them, you cared for them, and they just spent their life on your farm, how long would they live?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the oldest recorded hen is about 20 years old. They can live quite a long, long, happy life. I knew of a hen that was a little barred rock. She was 10 years old, and she would lay one egg every spring.
Wow.
And when she turned 10, in that 10th year, she decided that she wanted to sit on a nest, their clutch of eggs, and that she wanted to sit on them and hatch them out. And so her owners let her, and she did. She hatched them out. She brooded the little baby chicks and mentored them and taught them the ways and the culture of the flock. And then just about seven to 8 weeks after the chicks were sort of grown and on their own, she died. It's like that was her last service to the planet. So at 10 years old, they can still be pretty functional. If I have a hen in my flock that's going on 4 or 5 years, I can kind of consider them senior citizens. So you know, the reason I keep chickens is not just for eggs. So I view the older ones as having value. Besides being the pesticiders that we talked about earlier, they also mentor some of the young ones. They provide their manure. They're good in the garden, helping me keep the soil tilled up, with sort of in the chicken tractor mode. So they do have value besides just eggs. A lot of people now are calling their chickens pets with benefits. So the benefits are plural. It's not, again, just either eggs.
Let me ask you a question. When it comes to providing or just recycling different materials when it comes to their housing, I've seen people use old dresser drawers.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen all sorts of kooky things. Is that a smart way to go?
Well, a hen was rather, I mean, they can change their mind about what they consider to be a good nest quite often, which if you're letting them free range, you might have to go on an egg hunt every now and then. But one of the things to consider about nests is, and of course you want to, from the hen's point of view, she wants the nest to be dry and clean and private. And from the human point of view, you want the nest to have easy access and to also be clean and sort of pest-free. So when you start using something like a dresser drawer, one of the problems that might eventually evolve, and we had this when we had our poultry farm, is some of the wooden nests that they'd get little mites would take up residence in the wood. And then they'd breed, and before long, then the chickens just either wouldn't want to use it, and, of course, the mites would be so troublesome, so you'd have to treat it. So I've come over the 20 years or so that I've had chickens to really appreciate either plastic or metal nest boxes, because they're easy to clean, they don't harbor those little pesky things, and they last forever, pretty much.
Yeah, we had the metal nest boxes, and we used to put fresh hay in them.
Mm-hmm.
We used to just constantly clean them out, put fresh hay in them, and you know the chickens really like the fresh hay.
Yes, yes. The other thing that I really like in the nest boxes are the plastic nest liners, and the reason I like those so much, June, is they've got these little kind of fingers that kind of poke up that give support to the egg as it's being laid, and then they're perforated. So if there's any dirt or dust or even a broken egg, it'll sort of sift down through to the bottom of the nest, and then the metal nest boxes, anyway, you can just pop that bottom out, and it makes it really easy to clean. So,
and what do you clean the metal nest boxes with?
Oh,
I mean, do you have any particular solution that you use, or do you just use soap and water?
No, I just hose it down. Yeah, and of course, because the little bottoms pop out, I can just take those out and either put in another one or leave them open. I mean, sometimes if for some reason, say for example, there's evidence of egg eating in one of the nests, which is a vice that you want to stop as fast as you can with a chicken, one of the things that sometimes will work is you just take that particular nest box out of commission. You just block it off, or in my case, I just take the bottom out, so there's no there for them to sit on, and that's another way to kind of manage your nests.
I remember my dad used to take those plastic Easter eggs, and he used to put one in each of the nesting boxes to
mm-hmm.
encourage the chickens to lay the eggs. Do you have any other suggestions if you have a chicken that just is not laying?
There's two questions there. One is there are things called faux eggs or false eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be wooden or marble. Some people even use golf balls. But,
yeah, we've
but,
used golf balls. Yeah, I remember
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. And what those do is you can put those two or three of them in a particular nest where you'd like the chicken to lay, and often that will entice them. They'll think, oh, other hens have thought this is an okay place to lay. I'll put my egg there in there with them. And, of course, if you've got a hen that's starting to go broody and you don't want to use real eggs under them, you might want to keep those eggs to incubate or just gather them till you have enough for a clutch. Those faux eggs come in handy as well. And let's see, your other question was remind me what your other question was.
With what other tips do you have to encourage your chickens to lay eggs?
Ah, the other tips to encourage them to lay eggs. That's a whole subject. They'll start laying about 5 or 6 months of age.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you can have the nest boxes lower than the roosts, that's a very good idea, because that way they won't sleep in the nest boxes. And
why is that a bad idea for them to sleep in the nest boxes?
Well, because about half of the manure that they deposit is at night, and you don't
mm-hmm.
want that in the nest box, because then you're going to start getting dirty eggs, and that means more work for the humans. You just don't want dirty eggs, That's another reason to collect them at least once or twice a day, even depending on how many chickens you have. The other thing you can do to encourage them to lay nests, of course, is using those faux eggs so they'll lay where you kind of want them to lay. You want to make sure that they have enough protein in their diet, because when you think about it, the egg and the calcium that's around that shell is a huge nutritional effort to put forward. So I'm advocating that especially the heritage breeds of hens need more protein than is in the laying formulations for commercial birds. I think the commercial birds, they're pretty well timed to be done at 2 years, and they really cut the protein a little short. So I would prefer to have about 20, 26 to even 28% protein for my heritage breeds that I raise. They're slower to grow, and I think they're usually longer to lay, and they just need more protein than what the commercial layers
have. And what do you feed your chickens?
Well, my chickens always have pellets available, and I use the Game Bird Finisher to get the higher protein in there. And then during the day, I use an organic feed from Countryside Organics that it's a meal, and I add some water or some sort of a liquid. Sometimes it's from sprouting some sort of a liquid, and then that makes a mash on it. And when it does that, it makes it a dough-like consistency, so a lot of the finer materials that they would waste, now they can get their beak around. You want their food so that at least they can. It's a beak size, I guess you'd say. So that way they get organic feed every day, and I only feed enough so that it's gone by noon. I know that everyone has had at least you get their little cropfuls by noon, but I don't want to have any that's left out overnight because I do feed them in troughs, little ground troughs outside. So that's my approach. I always want them to have feed available. That's why I keep the pellets inside the coop. They're in a little pig creep feeder, and it'll hold about 25 pounds. So they always have food available. But then I want them to have really good food because their eggs are by far my main source of protein. So I make sure they have that good organic mash. And I usually do some additives in with it, like flaxseed or sometimes I'll put different kinds of oils in there, maybe some beet pulp.
Do you give them any organic vegetables, any lettuce, tomatoes, things like that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I grow for my chickens. You know, all the feed, June, doesn't have to come from bags necessarily. And that's
'cause that's what we used to do. We used to give them a lot of lettuce, tomatoes.
Oh, they love lettuce. Yeah.
All sorts of different vegetables, and, you know, they would eat it. And the one thing that they also loved was worms. But,
oh, yeah.
You know, I'm kind of a little protective of my compost bin. I don't know if I'd want chickens rummaging through there, but,
those worms would dive down so fast. They would get some, but they couldn't get them all. They move pretty quickly when they know something's thumping the ground up above. Yeah.
And with water, how much water do you put out, and how often do you change it, especially during the summer, the really hot days during the summer?
Yeah, water for me, June, is not negotiable, meaning my birds always, they have fresh water, and it's I have the philosophy that if I wouldn't drink it if I were really thirsty, they shouldn't have to either. So my standards are pretty high up there. What I use during the non-freezing months is a little tub. I'm trying to think the name of it. What they use sometimes to feed horses, it can either be round or sort of squarish. And then I put a stock tank float on top of that that is connected to a hose. So every day I'll go out and I'll just swish it out and I'll dump it out and then make sure it's clean, and then it automatically fills back up, kind of like a toilet float. So I know they never will run out of water, even in the hottest days. And the other thing I put in there is a little piece of wood for a bee float, because if I don't, the honeybees will tend to drown in it. But that float also gives my honeybees water, you know, when easy access to the water. Birds and bees actually do go together quite nicely in that sense. Now, during the winter, I carry water out. I have to, I usually put it out if there's a really, really cold, and we have not had a cold winter this year, but if it's really, really cold, I'll even take it out twice, warm water out twice to make sure they get at least one or two good drinks during the day.
One of the things that we used to do was we would take white vinegar and we would add it to the water to prevent any type of bacterial infection, so on and so forth, because unfortunately it is something that does commonly happen. But I remember my father used to do that, and it was quite effective as far as keeping their health good.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of apple cider vinegar.
Yeah.
Because I even take it myself. I'll put a tablespoon in a glass of water. It gives that fine, slightly acidic taste of wine a little bit. I don't want to have wine. But, yeah, I have glowing respect for apple cider vinegar, and I will put it in their water. And it does help to keep the algae down, as well as it brings a lot of trace minerals in. You know, that old saying, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Well, apples are just really good for us. So, yeah, that's a good practice. Your dad has a lot of wisdom about animal husbandry.
I think we used to tease him, and we used to tell him that he loved his birds more than he loved us. So who knows?
Well, I have one friend. It's Carl Mogensen. He's owner of the Natural Bridge Zoo. And, of course, they've got all these exotic. I mean, it's a breeding farm, so they have herds of zebras and camels and all these exotic things. But his favorite animal in the whole zoo are his chickens. And he says when he really retires, all he wants to do is sit on his back porch and watch his chickens, and he'll be a happy man. So they can be charming and lovable. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some can be more lovable than others, but there are some that are just real, real person of a chicken, I guess you'd say.
Now, Pat, what could you just give our audience? Say the top 10 things that you absolutely should do and the top 10 things that you absolutely should not do.
With respect to chickens?
Yes.
Oh, good question. Let me get a pencil here so I can keep track of where I'm at.
Well, we are definitely going to have you back for a whole discussion on Occupy Backyards, but just because of the time, because we're almost at the end of the show, I just thought that for people that are listening that have either just begun or are thinking about it, especially since it is not quite spring yet, but it certainly feels like it, just, you know, 10 things, the top 10 things that you most commonly see that you tell people to do and not to do.
Okay. I'm going to wing this a little bit, excuse the pun, but that's a good question. Well, I think with respect to the chicken housing, let me start with housing. Probably the top things to do are to, of course, have waterers and make sure they're clean and easily accessed. And the chicken water needs to be no higher than chest high to the bird, because they have to bend over and put their beak in the water, and then they'll put their heads up in the air to drink. So they can't be too high, those waterers. Now, on the flip side of that, the thing not to do is to let them get dirty water. I can't think of anything that's going to cause you health problems with your birds faster than having dirty water. So water is right up there at the top with respect to preventing disease as well as causing disease. Second thing is to feed not necessarily the cheapest feed you can find, but the most nutritious feed that you can find. Because, again, I think health starts with the food. And, yes, you can find cheap feed that's out of date or has been wet maybe or something. Don't buy it. So go for the most nutritious feed. And a lot of that feed, as we just really briefly talked about, you can grow yourself. It doesn't all have to come from the store. Chickens love people food, and just about anything you don't eat, they'll be glad to take care of it for you. The third thing, I think, would be with what we talked about earlier, and that's making sure that their coop or where they spend the night is predator-proof, because you'll lose your flock really fast if it's not, and that can be heartbreaking. So make sure that it is the chickens can't see, that they're totally vulnerable to predators at night. So make sure that nothing, including even a 2-inch hole that a weasel could get into. I couldn't believe it, but I had a weasel take out just about all my flock one night. So coop design so that it's predator-proof. And then after that, I would say one of the other things, the fourth thing to really do is to make sure they have enough room. I think sometimes people think, oh, they're just so small, they don't need much room. In factories, the factories are... Factory hens, the cage hens, have about the size of a sheet of paper their whole lives. But the chickens really need to express their chickenness, and that includes being able to flap their wings and run and take a dust bath, which I'll put in as number 5, is to be able to have a dust bath.
And I just want to point out one thing. It's interesting. The last time that I checked the definition for free range, it was something like... it was something ridiculous, like one one or two cubic feet per bird, and this is a couple of years ago. I really should contact them to find out if they've changed
that's
their...
That's about right, yeah.
Because I said to the guy, I said, have you ever raised chickens? And he said, no. And I said, so what was the brilliant rationale behind this? And, of course, it's politics. It's, you know, different groups that obviously have financial gain keeping things as compact as possible so that they can produce more. And, you know, that's what it's all about, the money, not about the humane treatment or the quality of what they're producing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So room is a big issue because in chickens, I agree, don't need much. But my gosh, give them a chance to again be able to run around, and the thing about the confinement, they are pretty well packed in there, and the environment has to be really really meticulously controlled for the climate as well. So, but when you with your family flock, one of the things I would say do is if, assuming you've got a safe perimeter or is let them out, you know, because they will go back at night to their coop of their on their own. But if you can just give them, even if you use a little temporary fencing to give them a little more space in your yard, that would be a good thing to be able to. And then along with the letting them out is put them to work, because the chickens do have skill sets, and we'll talk about that more the next time when it comes to occupy backyards. But the chickens have skill sets that you can employ, and some of those skill sets, just as a little bit of a tweaker to get people to call in, some of those skill sets can save big-time taxpayer dollars. And that's something I think that municipalities really need to start considering is how we are literally trashing so much of our organic waste. And it doesn't have to be that way. We can divert a lot of things with the assistance of chickens, a lot of biomass from the solid waste collection stream, and turn it into topsoil and food-producing gardens. So that's another thing, is put them to work. Let's see where we are. Dust baths. A lot of people don't realize that chickens, they are very clean if you give them a chance. And the way they keep themselves clean is they like to have a little dust bath. And that's basically what it is. It's a little place where they can get all dusted up. You can provide it for them sometimes in a tub or just an area they'll hollow out themselves to make their own dust bath. But you can put things like peat or maybe some wood ashes, some diatomaceous earth is often good. It acts as a little insecticide. And they'll just go in there and they'll preen themselves, they'll clean their feathers, and they'll be just as clean as can be. The other thing to do, we're on number 9 here, according to my list, is keep an eye on infestations like mites or even little body lice or whatever it is. Sometimes there can be a thing called scaly leg, where little mites get up under the scales. You got to keep an eye on making sure that the birds are infestation free. And sometimes I've seen it where it just happens. You have no idea, no other contact with a flock, but all of a sudden you'll see a little mite will show up, especially the little red mites at night. So keep those pests down. And finally,
what do you do to get rid of them?
Well, it's not that terribly hard, but it depends on what your coop is made of. And diatomaceous earth, I'll dust them, especially first thing out in the morning to get them kind of dusty. Sometimes you have to use an insecticide like Promethium. If you've got particle board in, they can get in and breed in the particle board, which is why I don't like particle board for coop constructions. And there's a couple other things you can do as well, but it's all in City Chicks. I mean, everything I'm talking about here is in the book City Chicks, and there's quite a section there on managing pests. And finally, the last thing, the tenth thing, I believe we're on June, is love them. And the thing not to do is just ignore them and assume that they're just not sentient beings worthy of respect. So they do deserve our respect. They are, some of them can be remarkably lovable. Not all chickens have personalities kind of like humans. Some you'll find you resonate with more than others, but they still are under your care and deserve your respect and your love. So I think that's 10.
Thank you, Pat. Now, just a couple quick questions for you. Mm-hmm. When you do get the baby chicks,
Mm-hmm.
How do you care for them until they get a little bit bigger? I mean, should you get a heat lamp? Where should you keep them? Should you keep them in the bathtub? I mean, what do you do?
Oh, my, that's probably more than we've got with 3 minutes to go into. But one of the things you want to do is you want to have your brooder. That's a little place where you're going to raise them. You want to have it set up ahead of time. And there's a lot of information on how to set up brooders. And I have a whole journal in City Chicks I go through day by day of how the chicks change, how to expect possible problems, how to understand their body language and what they're telling you. They will tell you if they're not happy. And I go quite a much in detail into feed and feeding of baby chicks. One of my degrees from Purdue University was in animal science, genetics and nutrition. So I'm big on the nutritional part. And I think if we, both for humans as well as animals, if we take care of the nutrition, a lot of the other problems just don't even happen. So is that enough to get started on brooding?
Sure. And I mean, Easter is coming up. Unfortunately, yep. There's this very sick practice of getting a baby chick and giving it to your child. For what reason, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with the Tractor Supply about minimum number of six. And then I think if you're going to be just giving your child some chicks, as the adult or the overseer, you need to make sure that the chicks will be properly cared for. So get a good book on how to raise chickens and follow it, and just be prepared because they grow remarkably fast. And I don't recommend bathtubs as a place to food them. I did that, and people would come and spend hours in the bathroom looking at the chickens, but then there's a fine layer of dust that just will spread out over everything. So I usually, but there are all many different ways that you can set up brooders, and we can certainly go into great detail on that if you wanted to later on, June.
Certainly, Pat. And once again, Pat, just so many things that we could talk about, and mm-hmm. that's why you're just such a great person to learn from, and especially Oprah Henfrey. I mean, what a great bird.
Before you know it, you're going to have some chickens there, June, you know. So I got to tell you, just about everything I've learned, my chickens taught me. I mean, they've been my teachers, and I say that with total pride in them because, I've kept them for decades, and just listen to them, and they will let you know what they need. So just be a little empathetic and let them teach you.
And for everybody listening in the audience, Pat is going to be giving out a copy of her book, City Chicks, which will be signed. So, Pat, what is your website really quickly?
Okay, it's goodearthpublications.com, G-O-O-D, Earth, then E-A-R-T-H, and publications, plural.com.
And if you go to the Facebook page for The Organic View and leave a comment about Pat and about the interview, some lucky person will get a copy of her book, City Chicks.
Yep.
We are at time, and I just want to say thank you so much, Pat, for coming on the show today. It's been great having you, and may the flock be with you.
And may the flock be with you. God bless.
Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with The Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.